Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show and find out how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake, Jay Lynn, and Reframe. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the June 27th episode of Pub Talk Live, the live publishing talk show airing the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. I am your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, board member, and agent liaison for Pitch Wars, and a library event planner. You can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description so you don't miss this show. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. If you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below. And as always, don't forget to like and subscribe right there. So I'm going to go ahead and bring on our guest co-host. Raquel Henry is a Trinidadian writer, editor, and writing coach with an MFA from Farley Dickinson University. She also owns the writing studio Writer's Atelier in Maitland, Florida, and serves as editor of both Black Fox Literary Magazine and Voyage YA. Raquel has been a featured author, presenter, and moderator at writing conferences and MFA residencies across the U.S. She is the author of Holiday in Park and the Writer's Atelier Little Book of Writing Affirmations. When she's not working, you can find her watching Hallmark Christmas movies. So please welcome to the show, Raquel. Hey, Raquel.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. You know, I'm hanging in there. It's a loaded question these days.
Oh, God. Tell me about it. Raquel said she's nervous about this episode, but I told her she'll be great. Yeah.
I know. I always say that about the live stuff because I do something like I'm on a live video every week when I'm coaching writers, right?
But yeah.
It's like private, right? It's not like nobody could just like stumble on the thing, you know? So
yeah.
I always get nervous for live stuff.
You'll be great. Jessica says, hey, Raquel. Ebony says, hey, hi, Raquel.
Hey, Ebony.
Excuse me. I have a little burpiness. All right. So I'm really excited Raquel came on the show. When I was first really like conceptualizing it, Raquel and I had a lot of conversations about it, and she helped me like, you know, talk through a lot of things. So I'm glad we're finally able to get you on the show.
I know. Thanks for having me.
Oh yeah. Thank you so much.
I think it's awesome what you're doing with it. It's wonderful.
Thanks. I have fun with it. I'm going to drop the link for the viewer poll. You have about 27 minutes to go vote in that. And the question today is, do you write long fiction, short fiction, or both? And when I was trying to think of a viewer poll for this week, I was thinking about, you know, my guests who are going to be on. And Raquel was just announced, it was a week or two ago, right?
Yeah.
As the editor for Voyage YA.
Yeah.
And then we were talking earlier this week, and you're like, if you have anything to submit, and I was like, I can't write short stories. So that's where the poll came from.
Yeah. I would like you to, though. I'd like you to write short stories.
Thanks.
So that I can have them.
Okay. Maybe one day I'll try. I don't know, in my spare free time that is so frequent. All right, so we're gonna dive right into the news. It has been a capital week in publishing, so we got a lot to talk about. I'll take the first one and then we'll just like switch off if that's okay. Good with you. Cool. Barnes & Noble has fired many of their headquarter employees who had been furloughed since March, including many of their buyers who had been with the company for as long as 41 years. CEO James Daunt has said they will centralize buying into two roles. Hmm. So that's the thing.
You know, I have to admit, I didn't know what centralized buying really meant.
Yeah.
I don't like that they had to fire people, especially people who have been there for so long. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think people for a while have talked about, you know, some of the challenges associated with the way Barnes & Noble buy books, but sure. I don't know if like getting rid of everyone except for two people is going to help. They did say that they're going to be able to place orders earlier, though.
Yes.
So I don't know. That might be helpful. I guess we'll just have to see how it shakes out. Yeah, no. So if you haven't watched the show before, at the end of the show, I drop all the links for all of the news items that we're talking about in the description. So if you want to read more about each of them, you can come back after we've ended and check out those articles. All right, you want to move on?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. my turn, right? Yeah. All right. Alexandra Duncan voluntarily decided to cancel publication of her 2021 book, Ember Days, after receiving criticism of appropriation. However, Publishers Weekly and Kirkus both put up articles about the cancellation, focusing on the Black author who first expressed concerns about the concept, leading to online harassment for the author. They've since removed the author's name and screenshots of the tweets, but Kirkus still includes the exact text and the tweet.
Yeah.
Dang it, Kirkus.
Yeah.
I'm happy the author came to that conclusion on her own. I will say that. Well, not on her own, I suppose, but like, she made the decision to pull the book, not the publisher. Mm-hmm. Not okay though about where they've framed the narrative, right?
Yeah. Because you took a thing that isn't really a news item. I mean, like a book not getting published is not news every day, you know?
Right.
And then you basically framed as like, oh, this Black author made this person cancel their book, which that is what the comments were saying. Like, if you look at the comments before they closed them down, if you look at the responses on Twitter, like that's what the comments were saying. So, not a good look. And it's not the first misstep at either of these publications.
I was very disheartened, though, by the amount of comments, because I actually, interestingly enough, like this past week, I wasn't on Twitter as much because I found that I have to distance myself from Twitter very often, or else I lose my sanity. But I went back before, you know, earlier today, and I was reading through some of those comments, and there were, like, on the author's page, there were more comments that were not okay. Mm-hmm. Like comments that, oh, you shouldn't have to, you know, cancel your book. Like, you should absolutely not do that. How dare they, you know, even though it was the author that pulled the book. So people were misinformed about that too, but
I still
can't believe that we're here in this spot where people would say, no, you should definitely write whatever you want, you know, like.
Yeah. And the author had responded to many of those saying, don't defend me. Like, this isn't, I was wrong. Don't defend me.
Yeah.
And they're still coming. Whatever. Anyway. All right. So we got a couple of sad things. I did make sure we ended on a happy one. So just a FYI. Oh, no, I didn't. The two before that.
I was going to say happy.
We may just cut that last one out so we can end on a happy one. All right. So just FYI, we're going to talk about sexual assault, but we're not going to talk about any specifics, sexual assault and harassment. So, but falling directly on the heels of similar movement in the comics industry, which is still continuing now, science fiction and fantasy has seen several authors accused of repeated sexual harassment and just harassment in general, including Paul Kruger, Mike Cole, and Sam Sykes. Paul and Mike have both been dropped by their agents. And it's an ongoing conversation as well. And the link, by the way, that I'm going to include for this is from, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he has a Patreon where he updates science fiction and fantasy world news, basically.
Right.
And so the conversation is ongoing. So I'm sure he's going to have an update on the next, it's called Genre Grapevine. I'm sure he's going to have an update. So that's why I included that, because he'll like keep posting about it if you want to follow that.
Mm-hmm. Once again, the world disappoints. I'm so tired. I am so tired. You know, I'm not totally surprised, but it is one of those things where, like, you know, I had this conversation with some of my writing friends the other day, you know, about all the stuff that's coming out about people you respect and admire.
Mm-hmm.
And having to like basically understand and realize that sometimes, you know, the people who we hold on, you know, hold to the highest regards or to hold or put on pedestals, those people either sometimes they're going to disappoint you or they're sometimes they're not good people overall.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of, honestly, it just makes me sad. Like, it makes me so sad. But I'm also glad that people are starting to hold others accountable.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that everybody needs to be held accountable. If we have to start calling out behavior that's not acceptable. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you have a similar news item, and then we're going to get to something a little not so depressing after that.
Lori Chandler stepped down from her position as debut author chair for the International Thriller Writers last week, saying the board dismissed concerns about a male author's behavior at an industry event. Other members of the organization began speaking out and signing a petition, prompting ITW to release a statement that named the victim and gave further excuses for their inaction. After further uproar, all but two of the board members, as well as the executive director, resigned, which results in a lack of quorum.
Yeah.
So, yeah, similar situation here where I think we're going to see a lot of this, though, a lot of organizations too being called out, problematic organizations being mm-hmm. called out for the wrongs that they've had in past years and even in some cases recently. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I know of lots of organizations, you know, that are problematic. So I'm honestly, I think it's a good thing. I know, like, it's good that we're moving towards making things better.
I feel like we're always moving towards that, and then sometimes moving backwards and then having to regain our steps. But in this specific instance, this kind of like blew up on social media last week, and and I was like watching it kind of from a distance. You know, mystery is not really my world, so I was just like keeping an eye on it. And then they released that statement where they named the victim, who had not been named previously. And I just tweeted at them. I was like, I can't believe you found a way to make this worse. Like, So hopefully they're able to get some fresh blood in there. They're doing a nominating committee to choose, replacement board members. So
are the board members, I don't know much about mystery world and things like, you know, the thriller world. But the board members, are they a nice, diverse cast of people, or was it just a specific cast of people?
Like the board members who had resigned?
Have resigned.
I do believe they were all white, and all but two of them were men.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's why we need representation on everything, right? Because you will help you not make those kinds of mistakes. Oh.
Well, all right.
Hopefully they can fix themselves, I guess.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that, see what happens. A month ago, there's some good news. Well, good news for people who like listening to audiobooks, which is me, in case anyone was not aware. A month ago, we talked about KKR, which is the company that runs Kobo as well, acquiring Overdrive. Quickly after that was finalized, Overdrive announced that they are acquiring the assets of RB Media, which is also owned by KKR. You may know RB Media by their app, RB Digital, which is another app that you use to check out ebooks and audiobooks from the library. The reason why I'm so excited about this news is because the RB Digital app is terrible, and I'm hoping that I won't have to ever use it again, and I can use the Overdrive or Libby app. Yeah. So this is like very personal for me.
Don't laugh at me, but I've not ever listened to an audiobook.
Ever?
Ever.
You listen to podcasts, yeah. Though.
I do listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
Something about me is really stubborn about my, like, reading, actually reading it on a page. I'm not saying never. It's just I want to, like, look at the words. I'm just a nerd, and I like to look at the words.
Well, I listen to audiobooks. Well, I started listening to them because I was driving. I would have like a 40-minute drive one way. And like, I'm not a huge music fan.
Yeah.
And I had been just like listening to the radio, and the DJs every morning would just say something so idiotic that I was like, why am I listening to this? And that's how I started listening to audiobooks. It took a while for me to get into them, and I think a lot of people say the same thing. They're like, they couldn't really get into them, or they would get distracted listening to them or whatever. And then I discovered speeding them up actually helps me focus on them.
Really?
Because, yeah, so audiobooks, if you've ever, well, you haven't listened to one, but for everyone else, if you listen to them, the actors actually speak pretty slowly. They speak slower than I think normal conversation goes. And for me, it was frustrating because it felt like it was lagging. You know, I felt like, come on, like, get to it. And then I discovered I can speed them up. And then to me, it's more like the mental process is more like reading because I'm just processing the words as they come in rather than like waiting for the performance, you know?
I know. My hang up is because I like to linger over sentences. I'm actually I view myself as a slow reader. It takes me, I feel like, longer than the average person to read a book. And it's because I like lingering over the language, and like if I read a pretty sentence or a cool part, like I reread it in that moment. And I can't do that with the audiobook.
Well, you can. There's like a rewind 15 seconds.
I mean, I guess. But then I'm not looking at it. I want to literally like glaze over. Like my eyes will linger literally on the words. I don't know. I know I'm very strange, but you know.
Ebony said, I love them more now as apps. I hated CDs and cassettes. Yeah, I actually listen to, now that I think about it, I listened to audiobooks a lot in my first year as a project engineer because I was driving a lot. And I don't know if anyone else knows this, but you can check out CD audiobooks from Cracker Barrel. Yes. Yeah.
What?
So they would have a thing of audiobooks, CD audiobooks, and you brought them to the counter. They were used, but you paid like full price for them. But then when you returned them, they like refunded you the price minus $4 a week or whatever the price was.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. I did not know that.
Cause I was like traveling all over at the time in my car, and And so you could just like, you see a Cracker Barrel and you're like, oh, okay, I'm going to go get the next mm-hmm. audiobook. They had like every Nora Roberts book ever written. And I mean, it was like a lot of mystery thriller, that kind of stuff. But but yeah, I did listen to those before. Now you know. Now you know.
I know.
It's funny. I don't even know if they, I haven't been in Cracker Barrel in years, so I don't know if they still do it or not, but yeah. All right, let's go on to the next news item.
All right. The Cooperative Children's Book Center has released the results of their 2019 survey on diversity in children's books.
Yeah, and I'm going to drop both of those links down below or in the description later tonight, so you can go check out the full array of statistics. Honestly, not much has changed since last year. There's some slight differences. Nothing that's statistically significant.
Even though publishing is getting more diverse.
Yeah.
That's what they said.
Even though people, white men on Twitter tell me all the time they can't get published because they're white men.
What?
Twitter's a great place.
That's why I have to limit my Twitter, usage, because I cannot. I just got back on Twitter. I know I'm like getting off topic here, but I just got back on like where I'm kind of like checking in somewhat regularly, but I was like off of it for a long time just because I just couldn't take it.
Yeah, I remember you were off of it for a while.
Yeah. But I'm like, now I remember why I'm on Twitter. Because on Instagram, I just have my, like, curate my happy feed.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I guess, like, on Twitter, I have a really good ability to filter out all the bullshit. Like, I just ignore it entirely. But what that means is, like, I'm mentally engaging with like one in every 10 tweets because you just have to like scroll past the others. All right, let's get through the rest of these news items. Yeah, we just have a couple more. Amazon has long been overrun by counterfeit items, including books. They sent out a press release this week announcing that they've established a counterfeit crimes unit, all caps, counterfeit crimes unit, to hold counterfeiters accountable to the maximum extent possible under the law. And this came from VP Dharmesh Mehta. The unit will comprise of a global multidisciplinary team of data analysis, experienced investigators, and former federal prosecutors.
Amazon.
I mean, like, counterfeit books has been a problem for a long time.
Yeah, right.
But I honestly don't think Amazon is really focused on counterfeit books at this point. Like, it's such a small part of their profit margin. They probably, but hopefully it will help some people.
Hopefully. I don't think they're focused in general on books. So, as somebody who has published independently, I can tell you they do not care.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know, what was that Netflix series that was about like exposing the truth of different industries and different problems? And the first episode was about counterfeits. Did you see this?
Oh no, I didn't. No.
Oh, it's terrifying. Like some of the counterfeit makeup items, and they'll sell them as like the brand name or whatever, and they have like harmful chemicals in them. They have like chemicals that will like burn your skin and that kind of stuff.
My god.
Yeah.
What's wrong with people? Just why
they're just trying to make it look like it long enough for it to get bought. Yeah.
But ethics.
It's frustrating, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Like, just have a conscience, for God's sake.
Yeah. So, maybe, hopefully that will at least help that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm tired.
I know. Every right. day it's a new piece of news. And I usually get it on Twitter, see?
I get a lot of my news on Twitter. I'm not going to lie. People are always like, how do you know that? I'm like, Twitter. I know everything because of Twitter.
Basically. Jessica says, I forget about Twitter a lot because it stressed me out reading. See? I'm not alone here. Oh, yeah. It's my turn, right?
Yeah. Go for it.
Minneapolis-based Grey Wolf Press will donate $25,000 to five Twin Cities organizations chosen by junior staff. They also announced an initiative that includes a 10-month paid fellowship for people of color interested in a publishing career.
Yeah. I'm this came out like almost 2 weeks ago, so like right after the last episode. And I dropped it in here because I was like, that's a cool thing.
Yeah.
That they're doing.
I like it.
Yeah. Here's another cool thing that a publisher is doing that I like. Good segue, Sarah.
Yeah.
Simon & Schuster has installed and started using a massive solar panel installation at their distribution facility in New Jersey. The panels will provide 1/3 of the facility's electricity usage. Audrey Vinet Tang, manager of global sourcing at Viacom CBS, said, "This project demonstrates that doing the right thing for the environment and for our business is attainable by generating substantial cost reductions under a power purchase agreement while also reducing our carbon footprint," which is a lot of like business speak for saying, hey, maybe we actually can do some things that are slightly more environmentally friendly.
Yeah. I'm glad they're doing it, because then it'll show others that it's possible. And yeah. That simple also, you know, it's possible and that simple.
Yeah.
And also the caring about the environment is real.
Yes. I mean, I feel like there's been like this kind of low key conversation for a long time about like how publishing can be, you know, yeah. reduce its environmental impact.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. They're basically saying they're making money off of this. You know, in a short amount of time, they're going to be, well, spending yeah. less money, which is making money. Right. So just yeah. do it.
Yeah, just do it. Exactly. Oh, I love it. Good job, Simon & Schuster, also this time.
This time, yeah. I love it when there are good things. I always try to include some good things.
I know, I
like
do too.
So much of it can be like so overwhelming and so much negativity and so many. Sometimes you're like reading all the publishing news and you're like, why am I even in this industry? And then you realize like the rest of the world is like that too. So, yeah. So I like yeah. including some good news. All right.
Do I read that last one? Or
we you can. That? Yeah, we can.
Read it.
Yeah, okay. Just go ahead and read all it. Right.
So some staff at Hatchet, J.K. Rowling's UK publisher, previously told the company they didn't want to work on her new book, The Ichabog?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you say it? After yeah. her anti-trans statements. Hatchet has now pushed back and said they don't support refusing to work on a book because they disagree with an author's views outside their writing. This is the same publisher who canceled Woody Allen's memoir after staff spoke out.
Yeah.
So, side note here, I've never read Harry Potter. I'm just going to be
really?
public about this. I had no intention of reading it. Now all the people who gave me crap about not reading it, how do you like those apples? but like I had no intention of reading
you're
it.
You're cracking me up. Oh my god.
But
I didn't read it until very late. I didn't read it until just a couple of years ago. So yeah. I mean, because I was like mainly in college when they were coming out, and
yeah.
Like, I was busy.
Yeah. It's just not okay. That's it, you know?
Yeah. But yeah,
I mean,
we've talked, if you don't know what we're talking about and you've managed to, you know, not avoid the topic for the past like several months, we did talk about the issues with JK Rowling in previous episodes. So you can go back and watch and figure out what's going on there. We didn't spend a lot of time on it. I think we mainly talked about Daniel Radcliffe's statement that he made. Anyway. Oh, let's see. Oh, Ebony said she hasn't read them either. She's only seen one of the movies.
I'm not alone.
I'm like
dodging, like before this whole stuff. You know, I would be dodging tomatoes usually when I said that.
I was before I read it, I was like, I'm not gonna tell anyone that I have
I was okay with it. If you make fun of me, oh well.
Like, I'm in YA, like
I know.
But my main connection with it, honestly, like, this is gonna make you laugh, Raquel, is like being a Slytherin just so perfectly explained my personality. So,
well, I will say I had to look up all the different houses because I was like, I have no idea what these people, what is everybody talking about? So I had to look up like each one of the things and like what it meant. So I knew that much, but that's about as far as my knowledge went.
All right, we are going to bring on Jennifer. So we are ending with a happy note because we're going to bring on Jennifer now.
Yeah.
Slytherclaw. That's funny. Yeah, a lot of kids love those books. That's what's so sad about it. It was like, it's so formative for so many people. All right, so Jennifer Baker is a publishing professional, creator / host of the Minorities in Publishing podcast and contributing editor to Electric Literature. In 2017, she received a NYSCA, NYFA fellowship and a Queen's Council on the Arts New Work Grant for nonfiction literature. Her essay, What We Aren't, or The Ongoing Divide, was listed as a notable essay in the Best American Essays 2018. Jennifer is also the editor of the all POC short story anthology, Everyday People, The Color of Life. Her fiction, nonfiction, and criticism has appeared in various print and online publications. So please welcome to the show, Jen Baker.
Hello. Hey.
Welcome.
Hey, everybody. Thanks, Raquel. I see the book right there. Along.
I know. I know. Oh, I noticed we didn't have it up, so I'm like, I'm going to put it up for her.
I can't. I have hair products behind me.
Jen had to chase the light a little bit. She was trying to find good lighting in her apartment.
Yeah, I moved my lamp to my bed. So I heard all this news, but I've been off Twitter most all of this month, and I don't miss it at all from what I'm hearing. So I'm like, oh, what's going on?
Yeah, we did our tech check. Was it yesterday or the day before?
Yesterday.
Yeah.
You and I did yesterday. I don't know.
And I was like, oh, and I mentioned something. You're like, what? And I was like, oh.
I don't know what that is. So nice. As of June 1st, I'm like, oh. And then people would still text me and say, did you see? And I said, Twitter is blocked on my phone. No, I did not. So I've heard about certain things like publishing paid me and other things. You know, the blackout, the day of solidarity. I get Google alerts about when publishers do things. I mean, I work for a major publisher, so we're doing things too. So I hear about that stuff. But in terms of like the Ember Days and like, I was like, I don't know who this lady is. I don't know. Another book gets okay.
We talked after we talked about yesterday. Last night, I was laying in bed and I was like, should I leave Twitter like Jen did? That sounds so nice.
It's very nice.
Just like temporarily.
Yeah, it is nice. I mean, I miss people because I connected with a lot of great people like Raquel. Via Twitter.
We met on Twitter.
Yeah. And I was telling Sarah yesterday, I was like, we met on Twitter when there was like 5,000 people on it and it was so much nicer and quieter. Now it's just like you're constantly terrorized and traumatized. So I just miss the people, but I don't miss being on it and scrolling for hours and hours and realizing like, oh, the sun went down and I've been on Twitter all day and so I know what's going on and I'm just angry and sad and all the, like, I don't miss that aspect of Twitter. I like being informed, but I don't miss that. So, oh, well.
Yeah.
There'll be another every
off,
day.
I was off of it for like a good, probably like over a year. I'm like, it was great.
Yeah, it is. I miss it back in 2014 and 2012. I think that was a great Twitter year. I had like 800 followers. It was great.
That was the last good Twitter year.
Hi, Ebony. Ebony's so sweet. She's saying hi to everybody.
Oh, yeah. Ebony's great. Yeah. Okay. So let's go ahead and jump right in. So first, could you tell us a little bit about the Minorities in Publishing podcast for those, especially for those who hadn't heard of it before?
So the Minorities in Publishing podcast is going to be 6 years old come August of this year. I started it originally with a former coworker and she went on to stop doing the podcast within the first year. And I just continued it on. And we were talking a lot, and this was 2014. And I had joined We Need Diverse Books as a team member for their first several years. And what my colleague at the time and I were talking about was the fact that everyone was talking about there's a lack of authors and books, and people still talk about that. And we are two women of color who worked in the industry, and we're like, you know, that doesn't happen unless there are more of us in the industry. And so we just wanted to talk to people who were on the publishing side. And it didn't disclude authors and illustrators and all that stuff, but it was mainly to focus on the marginalized people in the industry who were buying the books or publicizing the books or selling the books or making the books. We really wanted to bring those voices to the forefront. And that's what I've been doing solo now for 6 years. Is I mean, I've gotten a lot more authors because I get pitched a lot by publishers now, and I've become a one-stop shop basically for places. Like, I got a black author, they can be on your podcast, and I was like, I gotta read the book. But I've been going more back towards having publishing professionals and having a good mix of that. And so I've talked to editorial directors, publicists, designers, fellow podcasters, fellow We Need Diverse Books people when I was working there and beyond, interns from the We Need Diverse Books program, authors, independent illustrators and comic book creators like Nyla Magruder, who is, you know, it's funny because a lot of the people I had were at the beginnings of their careers. So like Daniel Jose Older, Danielle Clayton, Sona Cheripotra, you know, I mean, Jason Reynolds was on like his third or fourth book at the time, but you know, so it's just interesting to see. It's just like, oh yeah, I had you in the first year where I was just this like rinky-dink podcast and I was begging people to be on. And now they're winning like Newbery's and New York Times bestsellers. And Jerry Craft was the first person to win a graphic novel, Newbery, and he was on last year and I knew him because he did self-publishing. So it's just really interesting how the podcast has evolved and who's been on it and how their careers have evolved too.
Are you claiming it like the what is it called? The Colbert bump? Like after they came on your podcast, they got famous?
A good year or two after, it's like, oh, they want a Newbery? You know they were on the podcast before all that happened.
Yeah.
I knew it back when. Hi, Jessica. There's a Jessica Baker, and I often get called Jessica Baker. So hello.
It's so funny because when I was doing the promo tweets this week for it, because I interact so much with Jessica on Twitter, I would type in Baker because, you know, that's Jennifer. There's like 1,000. And Jessica would always come up first. And one time I almost tagged her instead of you.
I think that's good. She's a hardcore. Give her some credit.
Raquel, did you have a question?
On your thing?
sorry. Yeah, well, she already answered the next one, so we can skip that one.
Oh, sorry.
No, you're good.
Sorry, getting my life together here. okay. So, Jen, you do so many different things between the podcast and writing and editing for multiple sites and projects. Do you have any time management and prioritizing tips to share with viewers?
By the way, when I wrote viewers, I meant me.
Ask for parents. Me.
I would also like to say also me on that one too.
I would like to say I have, you know, it appears because I get stuff done on time, but I feel like that's a crash thing that happens for me. Mm-hmm. When I was in school, I was that person who did homework that night. Like I was that kid on Friday who did all their homework on Friday, so they had the weekend. And then something happened in adulthood where I stopped being that person where it's like, oh, that's in 2 days? Okay, I'll do it in 2 days, you know, because I just itemize what I have due by date and be like, okay, I worry about that when it needs to be done. And I will be honest that I prioritize the stuff that's paid first. So, you know, it's like, this means a paycheck or not. And it's also my reputation for someone who has hired me to do a task. And so then I have to itemize that. And then what happens with the free stuff usually gets pushed to the side, but I usually am very honest about people about that. So if I'm like editing something or doing something for free, I'm usually like, well, I want you to know I have several paid projects that I'm going to prioritize before I do that. And that includes my podcast, which is why it's monthly now. It used to be bi-weekly. I used to do two episodes a month, and I was really great at it for 3 years. And then I started doing more and more stuff, so I had to pull back on those things. And so it's just really been setting boundaries and being like, okay, if you're paying me for a project, I will meet that deadline. And if I can't meet that deadline, I will tell you as soon as I can't. If this is an unpaid project, then this is something that I'm going to let you know I have certain boundaries for, as in I may or may not meet this deadline, or I will try to meet this. Or if it's a part-time job with Electric Literature, it is like, I do it every week, but I do the amount of hours I am able to do that week. So some weeks I work a lot more for Electric Literature and some I work a lot less. And they respect that because I have a full-time job and this I'm a contributing editor. And it would be different if it was like flipped around, obviously. And so having a dry erase board has been really great. I invested in that during the pandemic. So it's right there next to my desktop. And I have the dates and say, this is what needs to be done. You know, it's like, send this to your agent. And I color code. So it's like the stuff that's paid is in green. The stuff that's not paid is in blue. The stuff that's super urgent is in red.
Yes.
I mean, and the calendars and all that. It's just a matter of what prioritizing and setting very clear boundaries and just communicating that to people. Because I really don't think about something until I need to think about it. So if I'm not doing something for you until August, I'm probably not going to think about that until July. Even if you contracted me to do it now or a month from now or January or something, it's like, I'll think about that 3 to 4 weeks before I have to think about it. And so I recommend, you know, just recognizing how your brain works. And some people work very well, like last minute, final, getting everything in like a day or two before. But I think we need to be realistic about that. Like if I'm writing a speech versus I'm conducting a workshop versus I'm on a panel, so I don't have to prep for a panel versus I am editing a manuscript on all that stuff. I think we just need to recognize what that means. And something that I've been getting better at also is the editing part. I realize I can't edit things I am not in love with. Even if I'm really trying to help someone get it to a really clear place, it's I just can't do that at this juncture. If I'm not able to, then I will happily recommend it. But then I think that's where the pay comes in. Like if you're being underpaid and the project's a lot of work, you're going to resent the person for that. And you're going to resent that your time is being spent for something less. But I understand these are really dire times. I have the privilege and luck and access to be able to do that for now. And God forbid if I don't, then I'll do whatever I need to do, because I was raised in a world where I was poor and homeless for a little bit. So I recognize those two things are, you know, there's privilege and then there's just like what you got to do, what you got to do. But you don't want to be resentful for what you're doing at the same time. And so that's why I do the communication and boundaries and just like yes and no. And it takes a while to say no, because money's nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, it's money. And I say yes, but.
I was going to say, first of all, I feel all of that in my soul, like everything, because like I was the kid too that did all the homework. Even like when I got home, I did all my homework.
Yeah. The homework. Gonna sit down and watch Cosby's tonight. Yeah. On.
But then like I in my adult life, and even now that I've become busier, I feel like I'm sort of like just like I'm literally a panster also with life things. Yeah. Like by the seat of my pants. You know, it's on the fly usually. But I also wanted to piggyback off of that question prioritizing things, but how do you say no other than saying no? that's my issue. I hate that I do this, but I'm a people pleaser. I always want to help, and it's very hard for me to say no.
Mm-hmm. I that took like a good year and a half, because I was just noticing I was always stressed out. And I was doing way too much free stuff. And I've been kind of loud online about that too. I'm like, I don't work for free anymore. And then sometimes I'm like, why don't people ask me to do these things? And I'm like, oh, I don't work for free. That just stuck real hard. And the main thing was the resentment. I was constantly tired and I was constantly resentful. And I couldn't blame anyone for me saying yes at the end of the day. And so I stopped replying immediately. And what I found was, if I was hesitating and I was asking a lot of questions of myself, then I was like, I don't really want to do this. Or they're not being clear, right? They're not, or I need to negotiate for something that would make me feel better about saying the yes. So that's what happened. I started negotiating, being like, I would like more money.
Yeah.
Or if you can't give me more money, then I can't do this right now. Please consider me next year. Or if you're asking me 3 weeks before to travel halfway across the country to do a 2-day event and then come back and I have a full-time job, I was like, that's not okay, even if it is paid. So it's just like I had to see what it meant. And the minute I had like a I just was like, give me more information and or no at that point.
Yeah.
That's where it had to be. And it had to be, I had to be paid. If I was traveling, I had to be paid. I was like, I can't, I was doing free stuff for everyday people because that's what you do. But
book promotion.
Yeah. But after that, I was like, I can't do anything for free. So I can't go to your festival on the West Coast for free. I can't do this for free. I can't do that for free. And maybe it'd be different if I didn't have a full-time job, but I don't think it would be, because I'd be trying to make money and still traveling to all these things and hoping I'm going to get book sales that result in royalties that I don't know that I'm going to get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's just, you know, I had to become a lot more analytical and more meticulous in saying it. And even most recently, some people were like, we want you to do this thing. And I was like, well, you realize my role at my publisher is not as an acquiring editor I work at Random House Children's Books. I was like, I don't require for them. I have editor in my title, but I don't acquire for them. And they said, oh, but you know, you could just say something along the lines that you might pass their work on to your colleagues. And I was like, I'm not going to do that.
No,
that's not okay. Yeah. Like it, but only if you like it. I was like, no, that's not okay. I was like, you're either hiring me to do the job and letting people know what my role is, or get an acquiring editor. And it was a nice chunk of change. I was like, I could use that money. I don't mind buying a new couch. I could pay that off. But I was like, no, it's like, this isn't fair. So I just had to ask more questions and get it. Because immediately I would have been like, oh, that's a nice dollar amount. Yes. But I had to dig deeper into that. So that's my suggestion, is just like, see how your gut reaction is. If you're really excited about it, just say yes and see how it goes. And hopefully it's all professional. You get paid on time. It's a good experience. But if you have any hesitation, then that tells you you don't want to do it.
Yeah. I was just talking last night to someone about, we were mainly talking about like the so much of the free labor that goes on in this industry, like all the different organizations. And you had mentioned, Jen, in another interview about we need diverse books, although all of those roles were unpaid at the time you were doing it. And she was asking me, she's like, you're so confident. I was like, I'm really not. But it just came to the point where I was getting asked to do so much that I was like, well, what are you paying?
Yeah.
And sometimes I ask that question knowing that I'll say yes, even if they tell me that they, you know, can't pay me. So like a library that I sometimes teach at, you know, they asked me to do a thing and I was like, well, can you pay this much? And with them fully expecting them to say no, and I'll just be like, okay, I'll do it anyway. And they said yes. And so it's like, I would have done that workshop for free if I hadn't asked.
Yeah.
And all I had to do was ask.
Yes.
Yeah. Ask for money.
I had a thing where I had gone to a conference that shall be unnamed, and there was payment promised for basically doing consulting work and also reading on the spot and things like that. And after, there was no mention of said payment. even though I was pretty much locked down on this, like I didn't have any time to do. I mean, I taught like several workshops too.
Mm-hmm.
So there was like no even downtime. And then afterwards, payment was not mentioned. And I said something to another, like some of my writing friends, and then Sarah LaPaula, the agent, she was like, you need to speak up. And I did speak up, and I was glad I spoke up because there was some sort of discrepancy or miscommunication. And I guess someone wasn't informed, you know, that like that was supposed to be a paid thing. But if I didn't speak up, I would have been pretty much working like a 4-day conference.
Oh.
Yes. Without payment at all. So,
no.
Yeah. So I was, yeah. But that was actually really hard for me. And it took like 4 or 5 friends to say, you need to speak up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or I have one of them be your representative. You know, I've had friends say, I will pretend to be your assistant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or get your literary agent on it.
Yeah.
They can do that too.
I'm new to this thing. I don't know. I didn't know that.
I mean, maybe not everyone feels comfortable, but sometimes they'll be like, hey, you know, some act as like a speaking agency of literary agents. So they might say, well, you know, my client said she got an email, said this. What happened? And so I'll do it. I have no qualms. If you want me to email people, I write very, very terse emails.
Yeah. That's another thing is I always get people to email me because so many times they'll be like, oh, I can call you and we'll talk on the phone. And I'm like, no, you can email me because I want it in writing because I want to be able to come back and say it. Jennifer's talking about being unable to pay authors. And like, I understand that too, because that's what I do for a day job is I book writing events and writing workshops and author events. And with very few exceptions, I don't literally do not have a budget. Like there is no money for those programs. But I also am aware that I'm doing that. I'm aware that I'm asking people to speak for free. Mm-hmm. And I try to do everything I can to both protect the authors, because a lot of times the people in my organization, they don't understand, for example, why an author wouldn't want to have their entire workshop that they get paid to do other locations on YouTube. And so that's something that like I've had to tell, you know, the people in my organization, like, no, we can't do that. You can't do that. Mm-hmm.
And it's transparency, right? It's like you said, Sarah, it's selling. So, you know, someone asked me to do something now that's virtual. You know, everyone's assuming everything virtual should be free, which is not okay. Also, but virtual doesn't mean I have to get on a plane at the very least. If you're asking me to get on a plane, I might do it if you cover my hotel and travel, and I won't necessarily ask for like a fee to, you know, But then it's like, if you really can't afford it, then you're kind of stuck with local authors, which isn't a bad thing, but it might lead to lack of diversity and all that representation. The same people come over and over again. Like, what else can you give us? Can you give us book sales? Can you give us, if you're a bookstore or a festival, can you give us like front room, you know, like as soon as you come in, where our books are up on the front for like a week? You know, are you hard selling, hand selling our stuff? If you're a library, are you putting us up for like months and, you know, commemorative months and all those things? It's like, you know, what leverage can you give to us in a way that will encourage us to go? And that doesn't mean people don't always do things for free. I don't not do anything for free. I mean, like, if you want me to join your committee, which is stressful, I'm probably not going to do that. If you want me to do a talk, I'll probably do that if I have the time and interest and all that stuff, you know. And I think most authors do. I have, you know, I was talking to Renee Watson and other people, and they say, yeah, they budget certain amount of freebies. You know, they don't never do it. They just budget a certain amount per year, or, you know, so.
Takes notes.
Just be like, you know, if someone hits you between May and June and say, well, I did my freebie this month, so I can't do another free, but hit me up for next year and, you know, let's get you on the calendar.
Well, the rule I set for myself last year was I won't pay to teach. So like a lot of conferences, they expect you to cover your own travel, cover your own hotel, and then they want you to teach workshops, right? And it's like, I'm not doing that. I'm not paying, especially when an event is charging people several hundred dollars to attend. You know, like your attendees are paying.
Yeah.
That money is going somewhere. I'm not getting paid. And you expect me to pay for my own hotel. Like, I'm just not going to do it. But then there are conferences like Jen's, actually, in the comments. Jen puts on the Coastal Magic Convention, and that convention is so much fun that I would go even if I wasn't an author. Like, I would just go as an attendee.
To hang out,
Yeah. So, and so that's a decision that I make for myself, because I'm like, I love that conference so much that I'll pay to go there. That's fine.
Yeah. I don't think people should feel shame in not having a budget, because so many people don't have budgets, right? But it is like Sarah is saying, that environment, what are you doing? Like, are you buying us lunch the whole time? Are you covering at least like, what can you do for us if we're traveling and coming all that way and giving our energy? And for me, being on a panel is very different from being a workshop, like you said, Sarah. Like, if I need to construct a workshop, I need to get paid.
Yeah.
If I'm on a panel, you know, like AWP Raquel, where we go and we're paying to be at AWP, which is a whole ridiculous thing. And I was just like, I'm not going this year. I'm not paying any more money. Go to a panel, get drunk all day. I could do that at home. I don't need to do that.
Raquel and I did a panel at AWP too.
Yeah.
When it was here.
You know, the thing is, I'm in a tough spot with AWP, just cause, like, side note, because I'm it helped with the promotion of the magazine, and now I'm sure with the new magazine it's gonna help even more. So it's hard for me to be like, well, I'm not gonna, you know. But I think if I didn't have Black Fox and now like doing Voyage, like I think if I wasn't in the magazine publishing world, I probably would be like, not every year, just, you know. Yeah, I think, you know, the thing with paying authors, I absolutely think everybody should get paid. And this is why I feel like, even, you know, being with the studio, I have to plan workshops. And that's why we only have a certain amount per month, right? Because I don't feel right going to an author and saying, hey, you want to do this? You want to do this free thing? Plus, like, you know, we charge for it. Obviously, you know, but we also, like, we're charging because we also have an overhead. Like, we have a physical structure that we have to pay money for, like, every month. So obviously we have to charge for some things. I wish I could give everything to everyone for free, but I can't. So what I got just a little bit more creative. So what we do is we just offer a percentage to authors. Like, yeah, that's fair. Because we don't know, we never know how many people are going to sign up. Mm-hmm. And we just say, hey, we usually give them the bigger half of the percentage, and that's what they get for teaching. Yeah. And sometimes it works out really well. Sometimes I feel bad, but at least they're getting something. It's not like, you know, unless somebody comes to me, because I will have authors who come to me who want to get the experience, and they're like, mm-hmm. can I teach a free workshop? Mm-hmm. And oh, in yeah. those cases, then yeah, of course, you know, but yeah, it's a tricky.
It is tricky. Thing. And also there's partnerships that you can do. If you can't yes. pay an author, can you get them a paid of gig in the same area? Yeah. And sometimes publishers are doing that, but my publisher didn't pay for my tour for Everyday People. Whereas another person I know who did an anthology at the same big publisher, but not imprint, they had all their stuff paid. And this person's a white woman, so that's another issue that we're getting into. But, you know, and she could go to those things that I was invited to, but I was like, money. Like,
yeah.
Her publisher's paying for it. Mine isn't, you know, my imprint isn't paying for it. And yeah. and that's another issue that people of color and other marginalized identities and disabled people, you know what I mean? Like, Kia Brown and stuff like that. I think she talked a little bit about that as being mm-hmm. as someone who's disabled and how much touring she can do physically. And then what do you do to supplement that? How do you help that? Are you aware of the needs she has to, you know, yeah. enter a building and to be comfortable for sitting for an hour, hour and a half, and then signing books for that, you know? Like, those things all come into play. So it, even if you can't pay, which we should.
Yes.
Be cognizant that's of what we need. You know what I mean? I don't want to be the only Black person there. I don't want to be there because you needed a Black person. You know? So, like, that happens way too much when it's just like, we needed yeah. a Black person. Hey. And I'm like, it's in 2 weeks. Not going to do it. No. No.
Did people say that to you?
It's obvious. Okay. It's obvious because yeah. I ask who else is on it. Do people say
that explicitly or?
No, they're just like, it. You know, when you ask and you're like, yeah. who else is there? Or they name who else is there and you're like, it's really white. Incredibly white. Hey, you want me to go to Kentucky? Do I have that right? No. No.
All right. Well, I could talk to you all probably like for a very long time about this, but we're really out of time. But I do have two more questions I have to ask before we do that. So the first one is from Patreon supporter Lodestar. So if you support the Patreon for the show, you can submit questions ahead of time. And if I choose them, then I read them on the show like this. So his question was, we all talk mm-hmm. about the importance of having minority voices heard. With your experience when collecting an anthology of stories, how do you choose which stories should be heard amongst minority voices?
Well, Everyday People was a curated anthology when I inherited it. And I brought on some of the people that my friend who had originated the anthology and passed away, sadly, brought in, but I wanted it to be a POC, a BIPOC, Black Indigenous POC. And so for me, I knew I didn't want this anthology to be something that was trauma filled. And that's not, you know, I wasn't trying to fulfill these kind of ways that we see like gang life and police brutality and immigration stories and the coming out stories and da 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 da. So I just knew what I wanted the book to be. And that meant finding the authors and knowing who they were or being introduced to them and seeking that work. So when I went out and spoke to like Alexander Chi and Mitch Jackson and like, and Nana, who I was introduced to, and, you know, other people, it was, you have full range to do whatever you want. And it just so happened that the people who were in it, because not all the submissions worked, let's keep that in mind. There were ones that I contracted and then was like, no, and I'm not paying you because I put that in the contract. That I wouldn't pay you until I accepted the piece because I covered my butt. And so it just really came together that these were artists that I trusted. Some I didn't know, but most I did know. And I knew that they could create content that was filled with something very specific and something that really spoke to character and motivation and voice and was very different and was worldly and was all those things. And so I think you just have to know who you like and what you enjoy to be able to find those people to kind of curate an anthology. Because I wasn't going to do an open submission call. It would have been way too overwhelming for me. And plus, the publisher really wanted certain voices. And I brought an introductory, I introduced certain people, but mostly they do kind of want, like a big publisher like Simon & Schuster does want like known people. So that's something you might have to deal with. But if it's your anthology, it really should capture the heart of what you want to say. And you can't always dictate that to artists. It doesn't work like that. They either are able to do it and you can mold it with them, or they're not. And that's fair because you're asking for something in a finite amount of time. I was like, you got a year, which sounds like a lot of time, but is not a lot of time after the 2016 presidential election and asking people to submit to work after that. You know, like that felt horrible to ask people around that time to submit work. And they all were like, yes. And those who didn't said yes, no up front. But, you know, that's a crappy time to ask people of color to produce something. But it was paid. So I'm like, I got cash. I'm like, I'm sorry to come in your DMs, but I got cash. Do you want to write something? You have free reign to write whatever you want. And you get paid, you know. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if that helps answer, but it was really because I was just aware of the voices that I wanted. And you have to be confident in that. If you're not confident as you're creating a collection, then it's going to be like a mismatch of something that might not really speak to a voice that it, you're supposed to have. And every collection should have a kind of singular thematic element, even if it's not very clear, you know, like, oh, all these are about police or all these are about racism. But Everyday People is not all one thing, but it is a BIPOC anthology and it is like very heartfelt and it is not trauma. It is like the antithesis of trauma. It is really a craft book. So.
Thanks.
Yeah. And I have used it in my teachings. So.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
No,
you're good.
No, I was just saying Luther isn't usually able to watch live, so he usually watches the replay because he usually is working during the show. But all right, so final question, the question I ask all my guests, what is the most important book you've ever read and why?
That's what's a hard one, and I happen to have them. So there are like two. Sula sorry, my right and left are all awkward. And then Zadie Smith's On Beauty. And Sula, I read first and I didn't really like it. God forbid, I'm so sorry, Ms. Morrison. But I was just like, I don't like Sula. like, who does that to their friends? I don't like her. And then I reread it and then I reread it and I reread it. And I understood the craft involved in it and I understood the larger story. And that, you know, because these are short books, you know, Toni Morrison is not like, she doesn't do doorstoppers. And I needed to appreciate that over time because when I was introduced to it as a teen, I just couldn't get it. And that's not due to Toni Morrison. That was just due to me not being there. And I think seeing how friendship was such a vital element in storytelling and Black women friendship was so key. And so her structure and everything was great. Zadie Smith, I reread this book. I love it. I love it. I love it. I just loved how she captured family strife, insecurity, love, and how she captures a character who you really don't like also, but you know he cares and loves his family, but he's just going through his stuff. And that doesn't mean that he should be prioritized, but there was just a way that she went about making you understand that got to me. And so I think these two books where you might have these quote unquote unlikable characters are really quintessential studies in craft of this is really about motivation, psychology, layers, and all that stuff. And they're both by Black women, of course. So I just think as like from a craft level and from an understanding of how do you build relationships and the importance of relationships, these two books, Sula and On Beauty, are just phenomenal, phenomenal, phenomenal. I love Sula too now, but Jennifer 20 something years ago didn't like Sula. She was like, I don't like Sula at all.
You weren't ready for it, right?
I wasn't. For yeah. Zora or Tony, I was not ready in my teens. I was just not equipped. I was ill-equipped. Yeah. And now I'm just like, do you know how brilliant this is? Like, we do.
Yelling at your past self.
Welcome to the club, Chad. Like, pats on
I think I had a similar experience with Sula, too. I did not feel like I understood it until the second time. And the second time I used it in my MFA thesis. So I had to do a bit of a closer reading of it. And I think that that's when I was like, okay, this is good.
And the education you get with it, you know, and it's not to say anything bad to my teachers at the time, but I think they were not as equipped to teach Toni Morrison and Zora Neale Hurston to Black kids as white people. And they were great teachers, but I don't think they were equipped to really delve into it and help us tackle that kind of work in a 15, 14, 16 year old mind in New York City. I mean, it's like, why are they talking like that? I don't get it. I don't know. You know?
Yeah.
So I didn't like Moby Dick either. And I read that in high school. I couldn't stand that book. God.
I'm sorry. I cannot get behind it. I don't want to read it. Like, I think I got through about 10 pages of it and I'm like, nope, done with this. It's a classic, but I don't have any desire to.
Yeah, they're just so. We could have a whole episode where it's just like, and you know what I didn't like?
That'll be the next spinoff show. It's like, what book did you not like? Oh, gosh. All right, Jen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for joining us.
Taking the time out. And I hope you stay safe in New York. And
you too.
We'll talk to you later.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Bye.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.
All right, that was fun. Yeah. I love it when one question just leads to like 20 minutes of discussion. That's actually my favorite thing that happens. So, all right, so it is time for the audiobook of the week. And the audiobook of the week is actually a slightly older book. Basically, what happened is about a month ago, I went and requested all the audiobooks of Jason Reynolds' books that I hadn't read yet. Like, I've read a lot of his books, but not all of them. And this is one of them, which is surprising because it's probably, you know, it's a very well-known book. And it is All American Boys. Yeah. So the All American Boys is by Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiley, I think, narrated by Guy Lockhart and Keith Nobbs. This is the quote from the publisher. In this Coretta Scott King Honor Award-winning novel, two teens, one black, one white, grapple with the repercussions of a single violent act that leaves their school, their community, and ultimately the country bitterly divided by racial tension. Have you read this book?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I figured.
It. I loved it.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. And the audiobook is really good too.
I haven't listened to the audiobook.
I don't, you know. I know. it's fine. I won't judge you for not listening to the audiobook.
Okay. Usually people are like, you haven't ever listened to an audiobook? Like, what's wrong with you?
Like, if you ever decide you want to, just let me know and I'll tell you the best ones. But
okay.
Because I do think a narrator makes all the difference. And so that's why I always mention the narrators. These are two, I think I've listened to stories narrated by Guy Lockhart before, but not Keith Nobbs. And it was really good. I mean, it was really well done. There's a you know, alternating POV. And I just think the narrator did a great job. I mean, the book is excellent. And especially like reading it right now is really weird because there's so many things that are like direct parallels to what's happening right now. When he talks about like the tank like police vehicle rolling down the street before the protests, I was just like, it's happening. Yep. You know?
Happening. Yeah. It's crazy how I feel like some of the books too that I read a while ago, like a lot of the stuff that's happening now is like the exact thing. There was a story too in this, that Fresh Ink anthology, which I reread recently by Nicola Yoon about. Did you read that one?
I didn't read it.
But it basically was a commentary on like innocent Black people getting killed by the police. So
yeah,
like same, almost like same thing. Only she put like she infused some superhero elements in it, which was a cool way of presenting it. But it's just crazy how a lot of this stuff is so timely.
Yeah. So definitely go check if you haven't read or listened to that book yet. It is good in audio, so go check it out, and I'll add it to my list on Libro FM as well. And we're going to discuss the viewer poll briefly. I have to share it, though, because I forgot to do it before we went live. It's right here. It's fine. It'll just take a second. All right. Let me get to the thing. If you write fiction, do you write long fiction only, short fiction only, both long and short fiction? But I will also say, like, this is limited by, like, my followers, you know? Like, it's mainly my followers who are seeing it, and I don't really engage with the short fiction community very much. And so I wasn't surprised to see that there weren't a lot of people who only write short fiction.
Meanwhile, I'm like...
You're like, who is this writing short fiction?
Come on. We need more short fiction, guys. Please.
Well, hopefully, because I tagged Voyage YA in that tweet. So hopefully they'll see it. Yeah.
Please write short stories, people.
What do we have in the comments? Oh, okay. Okay. Maybe someone in the comments write short fiction and we'll submit to you.
Yeah, come on.
I know. There are people do it. I don't know why I can't write it. Every time I write it, people are like, "Oh, this is a cool chapter one. When's chapter two coming?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, So I don't know. One day, Raquel.
I think you could do it. I think, you know what too, like, helps is reading a lot of them. So, like, I had some of the writers I asked to submit stuff, like, directly. I was like, hey, you should do this. And they're like, okay, I'll try it, but I'm not good at it. And I directed them to some of those anthologies, you know, those young adult anthologies that are coming. I feel like they're growing in popularity. But I just directed it to some of those and that helped. So I'm just saying.
I can write flash fiction though. I do like things that are less than a page.
But how can you not write? If you can write flash, I mean, flash is
my brain is hard. A weird place, Raquel.
Cause I love flash too, but flash is way more challenging than writing. In my opinion, it's more challenging than writing.
It is difficult. I don't know. I think I like it for that reason.
Yeah, I like that too. That's why I like it too. But it's still more difficult than 6,000 words. I'm just saying.
All right, so it is time for quote of the week. And so this is one from Edmund Wilson. It says, "No two persons ever read the same book," which I think is great after that conversation about Toni Morrison. Maybe even the same person at different ages didn't read the same book. I just like that because it speaks to the different ways that we engage with books independently.
How we interpret it, everything differently too.
Jessica says the same thing happens. I wrote a 800 word story. I keep getting asked, so I'm going to continue it. Oh, Ebony asks, what's the word count on short fiction?
6,000 words.
Yeah,
Voyage. Young adult. 6,000. Yeah, 6,000 words.
Or shorter.
Yes. Or shorter. Yeah. I actually, so I'm, because I am short-winded by nature. So I think like part of it is because like when I was first learning about creative writing, all of my like schooling and stuff started with short stuff. Like that's how we learn how to like write creatively, like the short stuff. So I think like that's where it kind of stems from, but I've always wanted to be a short story writer more than a novelist, but there's, you know, the funding
in no money.
Short story world.
I haven't taken an English class since since high school. So
yeah.
So what happens when you major in engineering and test out of all the English classes. All right.
That's cool too.
Raquel, thanks for joining me today. I'm glad you're able to come on, and I'm going to say goodbye to you and finish up with a couple of things, and I'll talk to you in a minute. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Sarah. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. All right. Thank you all so much for watching today. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like and subscribe right down there so you don't miss another episode, and tell your friends because that is how they find out about things like this. Remember, you can subscribe via email in the description. You can also find the Patreon down below as well. Thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. I really appreciate y'all. And that reminds me, I'll have to get this up on the podcast. So for those who don't know, Pub Talk Live replays are available both on YouTube here and also as a podcast. So you can subscribe to your favorite podcast platform, and it's just Pub Talk Live. The link for the links for the social media for the guests is in the description, along with information about Pub Talk Live. The next episode on August 8th, I just confirmed one guest today, but I don't want to announce it until I get the second guest confirmed. So keep an eye out for that.